Okay, we are getting ready to open up Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. Today is March 1st, 2017, and we're going to be holding public hearing on SB 5538, Board of Tax Practitioners. And today for testimony, we have the Executive Director, Howard Moyer.
Moyes,
I'm sorry about that, and Susan Gallagher-Smith. Please join us at the table. And before we get started, staff.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 5538 is the budget bill for the Board of Tax Practitioners. Just as a reminder, the agency is here today to give their phase one presentation. This agency will be invited back for a phase two discussion to allow the committee to have a more robust evaluation of the agency's revenues and expenditures at that time.
Okay, with that being said, welcome. Thank you for your time, and I'll turn the floor over to you.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Howard Moyes. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Tax Practitioners. I'm here today with our current board chair, Susan Gallagher-Smith, and I'll hand it over to her so she can kick things off for us.
Co-chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. I am Susan Gallagher-Smith. I am the chair of the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. I'm licensed as a tax consultant within the state of Oregon. I'm also an enrolled agent able to practice before the Internal Revenue Service. I'm a small business owner, and my business has been active within our community for two generations. Due to the forethought of previous Oregon lawmakers who worked in conjunction with concerned tax practitioners, I have the privilege of practicing personal income tax preparation and consulting under unparalleled ethical, educational, and professional standards. This is because every practitioner practicing or preparing personal income tax returns for consideration within Oregon is required to be licensed or registered with their governing state authority, attorneys with the state bar, CPAs, etc., with the Board of Accountancy, and everyone else is covered by the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. The Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners was developed as a result of a desire to provide the public with greater protection and practitioners with greater accountability and education. In a 1972 report based on IRS shopping tests in which agents posed as taxpayers, it stated that 97% of paid tax practitioners were either incompetent or dishonest. The Association of Tax Consultants was formed in response to this article. Their hard work within our professional community and the Oregon legislature brought about the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. Licensing of Oregon tax practitioners began in January of 1974. In our 42 years of service to the public and the state of Oregon, the Board of Tax Practitioners has made a significant positive impact for the public, the Oregon Department of Revenue, and tax practitioners working within Oregon. Prior to its inception, there was almost no tax education classes available to members of our state in our profession. Shortly afterward, classes and seminars were being held across the state through colleges, tax businesses, and tax organizations, such as the Oregon Association of Tax Consultants and Oregon Society of Tax Consultants. The outcome from a robust education system for practitioners is higher quality income tax preparation and greater public safety. John Lobdell, former director of Oregon Department of Revenue, affirmed this conclusion when he wrote, "My observations of Oregon's tax service examination program is that it has substantially improved the quality of tax returns prepared by Oregon's tax practitioners. The effect of the board's requirements for continuing education are evident not only in the return preparation, but in the manner in which tax practitioners represent their clients before the Department of Revenue. The board has evolved into a self-supporting organization dedicated to protecting Oregon consumers by ensuring Oregon tax practitioners are competent and ethical in their professional activities. Its strengths include a dedication to public safety by using a two-tiered tax professional licensing system which tests competency both in federal and Oregon income tax law at each level and requiring annual continuing education for all licensees and requiring new tax practitioners to be supervised, trained on the job, experienced. An emphasis on education and educating practitioners into compliance, developing strong licensee stakeholder relationships through frequent communication, volunteer opportunities, and other outreach opportunities. The Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners is also accountable and easily accessible to all stakeholders, the public, licensees, Oregon Department of Revenue, etc. Our executive director will go over our budget, several points that we have been tracking, etc. The parts that the data doesn't share is that the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners, which is alone in the nation in licensing those who are not covered by Board of Accountancies and the bar, that the board in the last few years has developed as an incredible resource to licensees, especially new licensees or those who are solo practitioners. Practitioners can contact the board with complex ethical and tax questions, tax law questions, and frequently receive an answer and citations from the volunteers who coordinate with the board by the end of that business day. Oregon Department of Revenue, 24 to 48 hours. Internal Revenue Service is not in a place to be as responsive. And these are valuable considerations. Thank you.
Is that a message that you would like to have conveyed at the IRS? I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I do advocate, sir, that licensing would be, I think, beneficial throughout the nation. I am particularly protective of our way of licensing because it has, from the data tracking that's available to us, it is effective. Something, the synergy between our three organizations means that you as a taxpayer, if you go contact a tax professional, your chances of having a tax return that's prepared correctly is better in the state of Oregon than anywhere else in the nation.
Thank you for that.
Okay, thank you, Chair Gallagher-Smith. I have a very brief presentation for you this afternoon. I hope that if you have any questions, you ask them, and I'll be happy to answer them either in the middle of the presentation or afterwards. Really just want to talk real briefly a little bit more about who we are and what we do, and then go into a little bit more depth about some of the things that we've done in the organization recently to reduce costs and improve services and our outlook for the next couple of years. As Chair Gallagher-Smith already mentioned, our mission statement is to protect Oregon consumers by ensuring that Oregon tax practitioners are competent and ethical in their professional activities. And we also have three core values that are very important to us that we try to practice every day and that we try to reflect in everything that we do. Those are operational excellence, service excellence, operational efficiency, and honesty and integrity. Quick overview of the board. As Chair Gallagher-Smith mentioned, we were established in 1973 by the Oregon Legislature. We first started licensing folks in 1974. We were the first state in the nation to require education and licensing for paid tax preparers. Even now, 40-some years later, there's only three other states that register or license tax preparers. California is one, New York and Maryland are the other two, and both of those recently came on just in the last couple of years. Our licensing and education requirements exceed those of the IRS. You may be aware that the IRS has tried in the past to license and regulate tax preparers. That was shot down a couple of years ago as a result of a court case. But even when the IRS was licensing and regulating tax preparers, their requirements were below what Oregon requires, both in terms of education and continuing education. So we're very proud of that. And as you can imagine, as a result of Oregon's longevity here, that we are widely recognized across the United States as the gold standard for how to license and regulate tax preparers. We have two individual types of licenses. One is a licensed tax preparer. The other is a licensed tax consultant. Licensed tax preparer is really an entry-level license. In order to be a licensed tax preparer, you have to complete an 80-hour basic tax course and pass a state-administered exam with 200 questions. You have to get a 75% or higher in order to pass the exam. Once you do that, you can become licensed as a tax preparer, and you have to work under the supervision of somebody that's more experienced, and that is a tax consultant. In order to be a tax consultant in Oregon, you have to have at least 1,100 hours of experience. There are some exceptions to that, but generally, you have to have 1,100 hours of experience. You also have to pass a more rigorous exam administered by us, again, with a 75% or higher score. We also require businesses that offer tax preparation services to be registered with the board. That includes both the main office and any branch offices that operate in Oregon. I'll talk a little bit more in a few minutes about the number of licensees we have and the number of businesses and so forth. I think, as was mentioned previously, we are completely funded through other funds, primarily through licensing fees and registration fees. Licensing fees make up about 80 to 85% of our revenues. Exam fees is about 12 to 15%, and the remainder is civil penalties and just other miscellaneous fees. Board composition. Our board is comprised of 7 volunteer members. 6 of those members have to be licensed tax consultants with at least 5 years of experience. We have 1 public member. Our chair is elected by the board members and serves a 1-year term. And the board meets in person at least 5 times a year. Generally, we have a couple brief teleconferences in between that if something comes up and we need to address it before the next board meeting.
Question, are these are just private citizens, or are these appointed board members?
Chair Manning, members of the committee, they are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, but they all are volunteers.
Okay.
They receive, I think, a $30 stipend for each day that they meet. But yeah, they're basically volunteers, and they do a tremendous amount of work for us, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few slides as well. But one final thing on that, I'm very happy to report that we have a full board as well. Sometimes it's difficult to find a public member, but we have an excellent public member. We have 6 great licensed tax consultants on the board, and we're good to go. On the staff side, we have 3 professional staff. There's the executive director position. We have a full-time exam and education coordinator. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes as well. We also have a licensing specialist and admin specialist. That is currently a full-time FTE, but our proposed budget will take that down to a 0.5 FTE on July 1st. And again, I'll get into that in a little bit more detail as well. We have 3 core functions that we perform at the board. Licensing, obviously, is the first thing that we do. As of last month, we had 1,740 active licensed tax consultants. Sorry, need to move to the next slide. We had 1,668 active licensed tax preparers and just over 1,300 registered businesses and branch offices. So the individual licensees is right around 3,400, 3,500 in that area. And again, just over 1,300 businesses. We do have an annual licensing and registration program, so everybody renews their license on an annual basis. That's split up between the 2 groups. The consultants generally renew their license in April and May. The preparers renew their licenses in August and September. Most of the businesses are owned by tax consultants, so they're generally renewed at the same time the tax consultants renew their license. That's in April and May as well. Exams and education is the second core function that we have, and this is where the board really plays a significant role for us. We administer about 800 licensing exams a year. That's an average of over the last 6 years. Roughly 650 to 700 of those exams are for the entry-level licensed tax preparer. The rest are for tax consultants. So we have about 100 to 150 tax consultant exams we administer every year. Because there is no national board of tax practitioners or, you know, no IRS national licensing program, we have to develop the test ourselves, and that's one thing that the board does. The board has to develop every question for both of our exams, both the consultant exam and the preparer exam. We also have four different versions of those exams because, you know, some people don't pass the first time, so we have to give them a second exam. So one thing that the board spends a tremendous amount of time on each year is going through every question on the exam. We provide them data with frequently missed questions. If somebody takes an exam and they think that a question wasn't correct or, you know, the answers weren't clear, whatever the case may be, we provide all that information to the board as well, and then they'll review the questions and answers. If there was something wrong with the question or the answer, we'll throw it out. We'll give folks credit for it that may have already took the exam, or we change the question in a future exam. We update the exams every year, and again, that's just a tremendous amount of work that's required of the board, and they do all that as volunteers. I would also like to point out that we have several of our licensees that assist with that as well. We have about 20 or 25 of our more experienced tax consultants that'll come in and spend a couple of days with us. They'll actually take the exams and then provide us feedback after the fact. And so we're very thankful of that. One other final thing we do in that area is that we ensure licensees complete at least 30 hours of continuing education each year. Two of those hours need to be in ethics. The other 28 hours are in tax theory and practice, either at the federal level or the state level. That exceeds both the IRS, that I believe is 18 or 20 hours a year. I believe California is 20 hours a year. The other states, New York and Maryland, are far less than 30 hours, so we're very proud of that. Finally, back to our core mission, consumer protection and compliance. We respond to roughly 100 complaints a year. That runs the gamut from folks calling us up that just can't get a hold of their practitioner for some reason, or they can't get their documents returned, you know, something simple like that, all the way up to allegations of fraud, theft, incompetence, negligence, and pretty much everything in between. Very happy to report that we do not have a backlog of compliance cases. Even though we do get about 100 complaints a year, many of those are able to be resolved fairly quickly. If it's a matter of, like I said, a return of documents or just the preparer getting back with them, we can call them, email them, and that's usually resolved in a day or two. Sometimes it's just a matter of the consumer wasn't happy with the service they received, and we'll contact the practitioner and try to get them a refund or work out some other arrangement that's amenable to both parties.
Just a quick question. Have you noticed any trends or any changes with the onset of new tax software, something like that, that's causing not as many tax preparers or people seeking licenses, or is it pretty much the same status quo?
That's an excellent question, Chair Manning.
Chair Manning, if I may answer, and members of the committee, I don't, it's my perception that no. Frequently in my own practice, I have folks who self-prepare who come in to ask clarifying questions because the self-preparation software doesn't create enough depth. It's hard to recreate that interview dynamic. And tax code is a bunch of, it's full of if-then. You have to make your best judgment and rely on cases that have gone before the U.S. Tax Court. Okay. So I have not experienced a change.
Okay. So people that are using the software tax preparation program, are you seeing any conflict, when they are actually filed at the state level that's significantly different than what you need or expect? In terms of the documents that the reporting documents that you need?
May I answer that question? Chair Manning and committee members, I believe that the folks who could answer that question accurately would be Oregon Department of Revenue. My uneducated, off-the-cuff answer is the same documentation is required for self-prepared and professionally prepared tax returns, I strongly suspect that self-prepared tax returns have a greater number of errors because self-prepared tax returns try their best, or the software tries its best, to create an interview-like environment, but that doesn't speak to every person, every person's education, cultural background, etc.
Thank you. Question?
Thank you, Chair Manning. Good afternoon. On the question of restitution and penalties, what kind of dollar volume are we talking on an annual basis for those kinds of charges?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, it really varies. The board has a matrix that it uses with minimum penalties and maximum depending on the circumstances, the severity, and so forth. I don't know if the chair would like to answer this, but we have the most common civil fines, civil penalties that we assess are for unlicensed activity. That's by far the largest. Again, depending on the circumstances there, it might be $100 per return filed. It could be more. It just really depends on whether there's other allegations of fraud or that type of thing.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Thank you. The context of my question is a question I've been asking every agency that comes before us, and I was looking over the reports for uncollected debt within your board. I'm seeing on file right now $624,000 in 24 accounts. So that would be an average of about $25,000 per account. And so I was concerned about that, over $500,000 uncollected. But when looking a little deeper, the thing that really jumped out at me is it appears that you folks wrote off about $3 million in uncollectible debt this last year. And I'm particularly interested in $3 million that we just said we're not going to be able to get. Help me understand a little better.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg. So a few different reasons why the board took that action. One is that the board had not written off any old debt outstanding accounts for several years. So a lot of those accounts were several years old, went back some to the late 90s, early 2000s. Frankly, should have been taken care of a long time ago, but they stayed on the books for a long time, and we took care of it. So that's the most significant part of that. A second piece is that prior boards tended to assess large civil penalties to get people's attention. There's nothing wrong with that. It does get people's attention, and when the orders are made public, it gets attention. But frankly, a lot of that is uncollectible. If we assess somebody $100,000 who filed, say, 1,000, returns while they were unlicensed, typically those people don't have a job once we catch them. They don't have many resources and, frankly, not much of an ability to pay the civil penalty. So we have a large civil penalty sitting out there. The individuals really don't have a means to make good on that debt. We will work it for 90 days. We hand it over to the Department of Revenue after that. They work on it for a year. If they're unsuccessful, they give it back to us, and at that time, again, we need to make a decision as an agency as to what to do. So, again, the two most significant factors there were a lot of these accounts were very old, some of them were very large, with really no likelihood that they would be collected on. So we did write those off. Currently, you're right, our current balance is around 600 and some thousand. I think of that, 580 is what we would call outstanding debt. The 50 or 60 is current. That is debt or a civil penalty that the board had just recently assessed that people may actually be making payments on, but they have a pretty large balance that's outstanding. The other, like I said, 580,000, give or take. There's one account that's $182,000. And it's an older one. I don't know why it wasn't written off with the others, but it is several years old. And same situation. It was an individual that prepared a lot of returns on license. Board assessed a very significant penalty. It's been with the Department of Revenue. There's just nothing to collect there. So I don't think we'll get much, frankly, honestly, with that. There are four other accounts that are between $25,000 and $50,000. Again, similar circumstances. We may be able to get some of that, but it's frankly unlikely that, you know, these folks will have $40,000 or $50,000 in assets that, you know, we'll be able to recover. And then the remaining 20 or so accounts are smaller portions, which we hope to collect most, if not all of it, as a result of efforts through the Department of Revenue and perhaps collection agencies. So we are staying on top of our outstanding civil penalties right now. We are trying to be a little more cognizant when we assess a civil penalty that it's a little more reasonable, so that we don't have a large amount sitting out there that is really, frankly, uncollectible.
Quick follow-up, a final question, Mr. Chair, and it's a little silly question, but I understand that many of these are going to be people that are acting without licenses, but if somebody does have a license and you find them and they don't pay you, do they get to keep their license?
No.
Thank you.
In fact, we've got a couple folks in that situation, and that's frankly one of the sticks we have to make sure that we do get paid, is that, you know, we will revoke their license, and, they'll be out of business and won't be able to practice. So the board has been very good about setting up payment plans for folks, if there is a substantial civil penalty. So, again, you'll see that in some of the outstanding debt that we have. One individual now that owes us $20,000. He's paying us $500 a month. So that, you know, that'll still be a relatively hefty balance for a while until it gets paid down. So I hope I answered your question, Representative.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One final thing I will say about the compliance process before we move on is that I mentioned we don't have a backlog, but I didn't want to give the panel the impression that we're just closing cases and not pursuing them. Last calendar year 2016, the board found 6,690 violations that they assessed a civil penalty on or some form of discipline. So that is quite a bit. There were 28 unique individuals that the board found had violated some type of Oregon rule or statute. Real briefly, I just wanted to talk about partnerships. We're a very small board, as you've heard. We cannot do our job without the help and support of a lot of other state agencies and other folks. I just wanted to mention these real briefly. Chair Gallagher-Smith had mentioned the Oregon Department of Revenue. I think we have a very good relationship with them. They've been very responsive to us when we've needed information from them. We have a good information sharing agreement with them. They provide us with, frankly, quite a lot of information that helps us identify fraud or identify unlicensed activity. So we're very pleased with the assistance they've provided. We're also working with them right now on a couple of pilot projects to try to find ways to reach out to clients of individuals that may be unlicensed, or that we may have revoked their license, or there may be some reason why these clients might want to be aware that their individual they've been using to prepare their taxes, they might want to look for somebody else. So we're exploring opportunities there. The Department of Justice does quite a few things for us. Like other boards, they're our legal counsel. They also assist us with drafting final orders. If we do assess a civil penalty or discipline and a licensee or another person and they have an attorney, the Department of Justice represents us. We do have a flat fee arrangement with them so that we can use their services as much as needed without fear of having a big bill at the end of the month. The Oregon Secretary of State is very helpful. Their registration of businesses is used by us quite a bit. Helps us identify folks that might have a business out there that are offering tax preparation services that haven't registered with us. So that's very helpful. The Oregon Employment Department is an organization we're working with right now, mostly the board members and Chair Gallagher-Smith. They're helping us get the word out that there's a lot of openings right now for tax preparers, frankly, more openings than there are people to fill them. So we saw that as a win-win. They're trying to help people find jobs, and we can't find enough folks to prepare taxes right now. So we've been very appreciative of their efforts recently. The Internal Revenue Service, again, similar with the Department of Revenue, we have a pretty good relationship with them. Might be a little bit more of a one-way relationship than the Department of Revenue, but they are very helpful. We often refer cases that we suspect might be fraud or some other situation that the IRS might want to be aware of and frankly might be a little too big for us to handle. We refer to the IRS and let them pursue the case. Local law enforcement, obviously we work with them if there's issues of embezzlement or fraud. We're also very thankful that some of the larger law enforcement agencies in the state will forward us complaints they receive from citizens that, you know, will go to the police and say, hey, this person stole my tax refund or, you know, they did this or whatever. So we do get some referrals that way. We also work very closely with the other agencies in California, New York, and Maryland. We have a quarterly conference call with them, which is also attended by the IRS as well. Real briefly, key performance measures for 2016. I think we're doing a pretty good job here. As you can see, the average number of days to process licenses and exam applications is very good. License renewals is less than 2 days, and exam applications is less than 3 days. The average number of continuing education hours licensees received. Our licensees take a lot more continuing education than is even required. They're 30 hours is required, but their self-reporting is an average of 43 hours per licensee. So again, I think that's fantastic and just shows the professionalism of the licensees that we have. The average number of hours to make an initial response to a consumer complaint. Just over 5 hours, and we've done several things there to keep that as low as possible. Like I said, quite a few complaints we get aren't very complex. We used to require everyone that had a complaint to fill out a complaint form and send it in to us. Now, if somebody's got a fairly simple complaint, you know, hey, this person won't call me back, or, you know, again, if it's something relatively simple, we'll just, you know, we'll take their name and number, we'll find out what the problem is, we'll call, try to get it resolved, and it's usually taken care of that day or the next day. So there's a lot less paperwork, a lot less hassle. The taxpayers are a lot more satisfied as a result of that. So that's helped us quite a bit. We've done quite a bit. I don't think we have time to get into all of it, but the satisfaction with our licensees, I think, is extremely high. We've done a lot of things over the past year and a half that they are very appreciative of. I'll talk about that real briefly. And then the pretty standard measure of percent of best practices used by the agency, we're at 100% there. We do have some proposed changes to our KPMs. I'll talk about those at the end. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those as well. Just real briefly, I've got a couple slides left. We've done many things to pursue our core values of service excellence and operational efficiency. I've only been with the board for a little over a year and a half now, but we have been able to accomplish many things as a result of the leadership and support of the board and, frankly, the great staff that we have. We have been able to reduce our current biennium expenses by 15.9%. Compared to our legislatively adopted budget. We are also at just over 20% less than our current service level for 17-19. Frankly, I think that's a tremendous accomplishment in a relatively small period of time, and more so because our service hasn't been affected. As I said, we still have excellent service. Our licensees are happy. The taxpayers that call us get immediate response. So I think we're doing our job very effectively, but we're also doing it very efficiently as well. Just a couple things that we've done recently is something that we're very proud of is we implemented a new licensing database. This is something that I know a lot of other boards are looking at, and it's you know, one of those perennial things that you know, never goes away. People always need newer databases, but our database was 30 years old. It was ancient. It was frankly hardly usable, and we were afraid every day we came into the office that it might not work that day. As a result of partnerships, there's one woman in the back, Heidi Zinsman from the CIO's office. She helped us quite a bit. Daz helped us quite a bit. We also partnered with five other small boards to basically take a existing licensee database that was used by the health licensing agency and transfer that to our boards. As a result, we got a licensing database that we knew that worked, had a track record of several years of being effective. We were able to offer online payments and online license renewals, and we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. And as a result of all those things, there were no development costs. The total implementation cost for us was $6,000. That was $5,000 for data conversion from the old database to the new one, and you know, make sure that it worked. And then $1,000 for travel expenses for our contractor, who was in Idaho, that came out here to Oregon a couple times. And frankly, he spent way more than $1,000, but our contract was he'd only charge us $1,000. So long story short, we have a very modern licensing database that is able to provide us, frankly, more functionality than we'll probably ever be able to use with the relatively small staff that we have. But we are very happy with it, and it has been up and running since October, and frankly, we haven't had any problems with it in terms of online renewals or payments or anything else. So we're very proud of that and very appreciative of the assistance we got from DAS and the other boards. We redistributed work assignments and consolidated job duties. We looked at all of our business processes, tried to identify any non-value-added steps that just frankly weren't necessary, so we eliminated those. We did a lot of work on our compliance process. I mentioned a couple things we did where we don't require folks to fill out a complaint form unless it is something a little more complex. Another thing we did is that we focused real heavily on trying to resolve issues and complaints in a non-confrontational manner. One benefit that we have that maybe some other boards don't have is that a lot of our issues are fairly black and white. You know, unlicensed activity, you did or you didn't. We have a lot of ways to know whether somebody did. And a lot of tax issues, although there are some gray areas, and Chair Gallagher-Smith can certainly talk more eloquently about that than I can. For the most part, the tax laws are there, and certain things are required. And so it's not too difficult to determine, yeah, they should have done this or they didn't do that or, you know, that type of thing. So what I'm saying is a lot of our complaints don't require a massive amount of investigation or a massive amount of resources to try to determine, you know, what happened and why. So we've tried to take advantage of that as much as possible. And one other thing we recently did, we moved into new office space on January 13th of this year. Our footprint and our lease costs were reduced by 31%. So we're very happy about that. We're still actually in the same building. We're in the Morrow Crane building. We just switched places with another board that was in the building. They needed a little more space, and we needed a little less. So it actually worked out real well for both of us. Very briefly, and I'm sorry, I know I haven't been brief yet, but try to go over this quickly. Just a few of the things that we're still working on now and that hopefully we'll continue to work on over the next couple years. We continue to look for ways to reduce costs and improve services. One thing that we're working on right now with the help of DAS is to outsource our licensing exams to an online provider. We've been administering the exams forever, you know, for the last 40 years. They're still paper-based. You know, it's 2017, time to get with the program. So there are a lot of other boards that have, you know, outsourced their exams, and we plan to do that as well. So we're working on an RFP to accomplish that. Now that we have an online renewal process, we need to encourage our licensees to actually use it. I think most of them will, and you know, they're used to filing tax returns electronically, so we don't expect that to be too much of a problem. But again, the more we're able to encourage folks that pay for their licenses online or renew online, it's just a benefit to everybody. We've done a lot of things to move to a paperless office. We took advantage of the fact that we had to move to go through all of our paper files, and frankly, we had files that were 20 years old, way past their retention date. So we're able to clear out a lot of things, and we are in the process of scanning in the rest of our files right now. So we will have, for the most part, a paperless office here by the end of the year, particularly with online renewals and online payments. We're also evaluating the tax courses and the instruction. I didn't mention this very much earlier on, but we do set the standards for these 80-hour tax courses that licensed tax preparers need to take. We develop the syllabus, the curriculum. The folks who offer the courses have to follow that. We haven't, frankly, done enough to evaluate those courses, you know, once they're being offered, to go in and look and see are they actually teaching the things they should be teaching. And another thing we want to do, and you'll see this in the proposed KPMs, is we want to ask the students their satisfaction with those classes. You know, did they think that they, you know, learned what they needed to learn? You know, was the material understandable? You know, just those basic types of things. So those are some things we're going to focus on to reduce costs and improve services in the future. Revenue also obviously is important to us. I talked real briefly about working with the employment department to promote the fact that there are a lot of tax preparation career opportunities out there. One thing that the board has already started on but is continuing to do, and actually Chair Gallagher Smith is spearheading this effort, is evaluating our exams. You know, in order to get a license, you have to pass the state administered exam. The board is looking at those exams to make sure that we're asking the right questions, that we're testing individuals on the right thing, so that, one, that we're sure they're competent to prepare returns when we give them a license, and two, that we're not asking them questions that aren't necessary or that, you know, might be on their, might be beyond their entry-level knowledge and expertise. We will continue to expand our proactive compliance. I can talk a lot more about that, but I know we're running short on time. And we will continue to look at our fee structure and raise those if and when necessary. The last time the board raised fees was in 2008, so it's been, you know, 9 or 10 years since the board has raised fees. We've always, I think, operated frugally, and we will continue to do so. With that, I will answer any questions, or I can talk a little bit more about our proposed KPMs if you would prefer me to do that as well. But thank you.
I would like to request that.
That KPMs?
Yeah.
All right. KPMs. Let me see if I can actually find them here.
It's the broccoli of Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm. No, I love it.
There they are. Okay. So let's see what we've got here. So we have six current KPMs. We have proposed basically to replace those six. We're not asking for fewer KPMs. We just think that there's some that are a little bit more relevant for what it is we're trying to do. The first two are very similar to the current KPMs that we have. The current KPMs measure the average number of days it takes us to process an exam application or a licensing application. There's absolutely nothing wrong with those measures. Those are things we will continue to measure, and it's good information to know. But one thing that we think is more important is to set a specific date or number of days, a specific target, and see, you know, what percentage of licensees are we actually processing, you know, by that date. So one thing that we're proposing for both license applications and exam applications is to set a goal that we would process 95% of those within 3 days of receipt. Let me go to my page so I can talk about them a little bit more. So those are the first two measures. The third measure we have is the average number of continuing education hours. That's one, frankly, I think that just isn't really that relevant or useful. It's good to know. Again, we'll continue to measure it. Licensees have to report to us the number of CE hours that they complete. So we're able to determine whether they completed the 30 that's required and if they took any more. But frankly, we don't have any way to make them take more than 30. So it's not really an actionable measure for us. What we think is more important is whether the licensees are actually completing the 30 hours of CE each year or not. So one thing that we do, and we've been doing this for a long time, is we randomly select 10 to 20% of our licensees each year, and we require them to provide us with documentation of their CE hours that they completed in the prior 12-month period. And so what we propose to measure is the percentage of those licensees that we audit that actually completed their CE hours as required. That is something that's much more actionable on the part of the board, so that if we get quite a few folks that aren't completing their 30 hours like they should, that alerts us to a problem and there's things we need to do there. If, you know, we're at 99 or 100%, that's a good thing, and maybe we should be focusing on something else. But that's one measure that we propose as a replacement there. KPM number four gets to the number amount of time it takes to respond to complaints. Again, nothing wrong with the measure we have. I don't particularly like it because it's hours and it's you know, are you talking about 8 hours in a business day? Is it 24 hours? You know, what is it? It's just kind of confusing. Again, I think the most important thing is, are we responding to complaints in a timely fashion? And so a measure that says, okay, we're responding to 90% or 95% within a couple days, I think tells you, tells our stakeholders, you know, what they need to know. KPM 5 and 6, these are very new measures. And I touched on them really briefly, but our current KPM number 5 is the general customer satisfaction percentage. That's a very difficult thing to measure. One, we're a regulatory agency, and two, people just don't like filling out customer surveys. So we tried to look at, you know, what is really important to our licensees. And what we've determined is that the thing that's most important to licensees is the KPM 1 and 2. Are we processing their applications timely and efficiently? Most of our licensees, that's the only interaction they have with us over the course of a year, you know, unless we're auditing them or they had a complaint. That's really the only interaction they have with the agency. So I think the KPM 1 and 2 gets at, to a large extent, satisfaction and how well we're providing service to our licensees. So as I mentioned, we haven't really looked too much at the 80-hour courses that are required for prospective licensees. We want to go out and look at those. We want to ask all the students who completed those courses, again, what they thought of them. So we think that's important, and that's an actionable measure where, depending on the feedback we get from the licensees, we can go back to the sponsor, to the instructor, to whoever, and say, look, you know, maybe you need to do this different. Students said you weren't covering this, or that didn't make sense. Again, it's something we can act on and actually improve the process. And then finally, KPM number 6, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the 15 components that make up that measure now, but frankly, we're doing all of them. I think a lot of other boards are too. So it's not an actionable measure. There's nothing we can do better. So is there something else that's that again, the board is focusing on that maybe we can take some action on? So one thing that the board has been looking at very closely in recent years is the pass rate on the exam, on the prepare exam, which is the entry level one. The pass rate in the most recent couple years has been around 30-40%. That's obviously a little low. That's lower than the board would like. So, again, we want to set a measure for the board that we want to get that pass rate up to at least 50% in the short term, and then, you know, look and see what an appropriate pass rate is after that. And there are many things we can do there, not just making the test easier, but, again, going back to the courses themselves, making sure the courses are teaching the right things. And then the board and the ongoing efforts that they have to look at the questions and make sure they're worded correctly, that they're not too advanced or they're, you know, those types of things. So again, we think that the proposed KPM number 6 with the a pass rate is something that's a little more relevant to our current efforts and something that's very important to our prospective licensees and to what we currently do as a board. So I hope I went over that sufficiently enough, but I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Questions? Yeah, Representative Marsh?
Mine is not about the KPMs, if there's anyone who wanted to ask about that. Different question.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at the website, and I haven't quickly seen a place where I, as a member of the public, can look up to see if my tax preparer is licensed. Is that, am I missing it, or is it not here?
Yes, it should be there. If you go to our main page on the left-hand side, there's several links there. One of them says, I think, license verification, I believe.
Oh.
And that is actually, that's a new tool. I didn't mention that, but as part of our new database that we got a few months ago, we now have a much more user-friendly and much more comprehensive online database where folks can look up their prepare to see if they're licensed or not. So they can search that by name, by city, by license number if they know it, and it'll tell them whether they're licensed or not, the type of license, whether they're a consultant or a prepare, and when their license expires. We also have on the front page of our website, it's probably a little bit farther down and may not be as visible as that, but we have a list of disciplinary actions that the board has taken, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years. I can't remember the exact time frame, but we try to keep it within the last 3 or 4 years. So after every board meeting, when the board, you know, if they assess any civil penalties or discipline, we update that list. We put it back out on the website. So, you know, again, the public can see if they're interested, you know, has my preparer, you know, done anything wrong in the past? And then that information's there and they can contact us if they have, you know, any questions.
Thank you, because it clearly you have a couple different audiences, one being the tax preparers themselves, but also the value of this to the public. So it's as obvious as that information can be on the website. I think it's a great service.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I may just have missed this, but you mentioned you're going to take your licensing admin specialist down to 0.5 FTE this year. And then you said you were going to talk about it later. I might have missed it. But.
You're right. Okay. I skipped it. Not on purpose, but just forgot. So thank you for that, Co-Chair Manning and Representative Fahey. Yeah, we have we've gone from 4 FTEs down to 3 where we currently are. We're proposing to go from 3 FTEs to 2.5 effective July 1st. We are confident that that is sufficient for a couple different reasons. One is, like I said, the new licensing database that we just implemented reduces just a tremendous amount of work because we're no longer getting all this paper in. We no longer have to process payments. A lot of information is available there on the web now. So our work has already gone down significantly there. The second piece that we're working on, which I didn't tie all together, is the outsourcing of the exam administration. As you can imagine, since we still use paper exams, the whole process is paper-based. People send us a paper application. We have to review it. We have to coordinate with several proctoring sites across the state to find a date and time that works for the student who wants to take the exam. It's just a very labor-intensive process. It takes a lot of time. When we're able to outsource that function, our role at that point will be simply notifying the exam company that somebody's eligible to take the exam, and then they handle everything else after that point. So really, as a result of those automation efforts, we've been able to reduce the amount of work required significantly. And so we're confident that 2.5 FTEs is sufficient. One other thing that we've done is we went out and looked at other licensing boards in Oregon that had similar number of licensees to look at how many staff they had, you know, what their budget was. So we tried to benchmark ourselves with them to see, you know, again, what was a reasonable number of staff for the number of licensees and so forth. And so two and a half FTEs is right in the ballpark. I've got a list of a couple agencies that you know, just off the top of my head that we looked at, but geologist examiners, the optometry boards, physical therapists, architect examiners, landscape contractors, these are other boards in town that, again, are pretty similar to us in the size, number of licensees, the amount of work, and they range from 2 to 3 FTEs for the most part. And so I'm very confident that we'll be sufficiently staffed with the automation resources that we have in place and planned.
Well, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? No questions? Thank you very much for your very insightful. I can tell that you enjoy tax. Thank you. And Robert, you have 2 minutes, sir. How fast can you get through this? I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
He's good.
Thank you, Chair.
He's good.
All right, Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Otero, and I'm an analyst with the DAS Chief Financial Office. Again, this presentation is a standard presentation from our office to orient the committee with the governor's budget and recommendations. Okay. This slide just basically is another overview of the agency. I won't go into too much detail since the agency kind of already addressed this. The agency's emerging issues, they've had a decrease in licensure over the past few bienniums and has led to a decrease in revenue. And with that, the agency has streamlined some resources and able to offset their expenditures. And so what the governor's budget is reduces current services to what the agency recommended as well. And this chart shows the expenditures for the agency. The difference there is from current service level. If the agency was to continue basically from 2015-17 ledge approved, would be higher. So in the governor's budget, this shows the reduction in FTE and the agency's expenses right about $1 million. The agency's budget, this just breaks down the two categories that the agency has, 55% personal services, and then the rest is services and supplies. Okay, in this chart is the revenue history for the agency. As you could see, the revenue has basically remained similar to the 2015 or 2013-15 actuals, and what the agency has been using a large percentage of their beginning balance to offset the expenditures for the agency. As far as investments, there's really no investments for the agencies, just reducing the current services. There are some statewide adjustments to the price list and state government service charges, which reduces expenditures for the agency. And there is a one minor adjustment that takes some savings for the agency and uses that for some licensing costs for their database for 17-19. And with that, that concludes my presentation. Are there any other questions?
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, sir. You are very proficient at your work that you do, and I do appreciate it. We have no one. Is there anyone else that would like to offer any type of testimony as to the bill that we're looking at right now? If not, staff, anything else? Anything else from the committee? If not, we will be adjourning, and we will reconvene tomorrow at 1500. That's 3 o'clock for civilians. We are adjourned.
What are we doing tomorrow?
Tomorrow. 3 o'clock for civilians.